This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
From Brandeis University, welcome to a special Recall This Book, where we assemble scholars and writers from different disciplines to make sense of contemporary issues, problems, and events. What's special? Well, this is a live recording of a critical conversation that took place at Brandeis as part of our Multi-Species Month, and in response to the appearance on campus of Peter Godfrey Smith talking about his book Other Minds and the challenges posed by the alterity of octopus consciousness. So we assembled three scholars, one of them is me, to discuss from various disciplinary perspectives what we make of the alterity of other animal forms of being, experience, consciousness, and intelligence, and how they interact with the human. And specifically, you will hear a neuroscientist, Gina Trigiano, and the anthropologist, Patricia Alvarez Astacio, and me, talking mostly about Patricia's work, which is centered on alpaca human communities in the Peruvian Andes. And our conversation ranges beyond that, but in the show notes, you'll find ways to go back and pick out links to her scholarly work and also to her visual work, because she's a filmmaker as well, taking advantage of the high visual appeal of those human alpaca interactions that she discusses. So with that, we pivot to the actual recording of that live event.
Welcome to the first critical conversation of this year. My name is Matthew Hedrick. I'm a physics professor, and I'm the chair of the First Year Experience Critical Conversations Committee. And on behalf of the committee, I'd like to welcome all of you to this first critical conversation of the year, which is on the topic, Other Minds Forming Communities with Non-Human Animals. The idea with these critical conversations is to showcase the intellectual vibrancy of Brandeis, in particular across fields. And so our moderator and discussants today, I think, really embody that. So my job is just to introduce them and then shut up and let them have an interesting conversation. But I think what's interesting is they really span what you could call the intellectual diameter of the university. They're from three very different areas. We have Patricia Alvarez Astacio, who is in the middle, who's an assistant professor of anthropology and who studied various things, including the alpaca wool and clothing industry in Peru. And what's interesting is she not only does her scholarship in the usual form of the written word, but is also a filmmaker. The other discussant we have today is Gina Trigiano, who's a Levitan professor of vision and a world-famous neuroscientist who has done very important work understanding plasticity and stability, the interplay between plasticity and stability in neuronal circuits in the brain. And the moderator today is John Plotz, Mandel Professor of the Humanities, whose scholarship is in English literature and ranges from Victorian literature to science fiction and beyond, whose intellect ranges well beyond that, and as illustrated, for example, that by the fact that he has not one but two podcasts on books, which I find really impressive, and is also one of the organizers of a prison education project, the Brandeis Educational Justice Initiative. So here we have these three formidable intellects who are going to talk about this topic that comes from the first-year book that I hope you all read, that I found quite fascinating myself, Other Minds. And so as I promised, after introducing them, I would shut up. And so now I will leave it to, I guess, John, who will explain how it's going to happen today.
Yeah. This is going to be a conversation mainly between Gina and Patricia, and I'm really just going to be here lobbing questions at them, but then there's going to be plenty of time for you guys to ask questions as well, and you can see there's a couple of microphones, so we're going to pivot to that sort of open conversation format towards the end of the hour. As you know, the organizing principle for today's conversation is the idea of multi-species community. And I guess if we have an ethical agenda, I'm going to try to sum it up in one word, which is anti-anthropocentrism. It's kind of a portmanteau word, but it's one word. We share this world with innumerable species. Gina, I had millions, but I was afraid Gina was going to correct me, with lots and lots of species, many of which have complex social systems and high intelligence. So can these species communities inform how we approach global communal challenges, such as the degradation of the environment? And so, as you just heard, this conversation is definitely inspired by the New Student Book Forum selection, and one of the chairs of that committee, Gina, is here. And that selection was Other Minds, The Octopus, the Sea, and the Deep Origins of Consciousness by Peter Godfrey Smith. So basically, as we speak here today, I want you to picture an octopus. That is, I want you to think about what Godfrey Smith had to say about the various models of cognition, sensation, and experience that we actually encounter in the animal species we know. And I would say this is even true for our backyard pets or our dogs and cats. You know, there's difference going on there, interesting difference. And also consider what that diversity right here on Earth has to tell us about the potentiality of even greater diversity. So yeah, I'm into science fiction, but I will say whether those other consciousnesses and forms of cognition that we can imagine really exist or not, like actually, nonetheless, the thought experiment is crucial for the anti-anthropocentrism that I think a Brandeis education is going to help you to cultivate. So I just want to say one word before we begin about a person who isn't up here on the stage but is really important, Elizabeth Ferry, who I'm not sure if she's here today, but she is. Oh, good. She inaugurated. Where's your hand, Ferry? Oh, yeah. Yes, your glasses, too. Okay. So Elizabeth Ferry really had the germinal insight for this conversation, but she's the man behind the curtain there. So let me turn now to Gina and Patricia, the stars of the show. And basically, if I could put you on the spot, could you each just say maybe one sentence or one paragraph about what you hope we'll get out of today's conversation?
Sure. Hi, everyone. It's a lot of fun to be here. It's been a lot of fun sort of planning what we were going to do today. I guess as a biologist, I'm really keenly aware of our connections to other species and the really intricate web that we exist within. And we rely on this web for our life, you know, for food, for clean air, for clean water. It's really impacts so many aspects of our lives. And yet, humans have modified our environment to such an incredible degree that we can exist, you know, we can go for long periods of time without ever really encountering or noticing those connections. And so I guess if I had a hope from this conversation, what you might get out of it is that it would prompt you to really to open your eyes and to look for these connections, to see them, maybe even to feel them.
Yes. So I think I have the same hope as Gina, and I come from it from a different angle, right? I think that not only we don't notice them, but it's about kind of reattuning, and this reattuning also makes us think about our own culture and our own communities and how we've learned to see or not to see the environment. So how can we kind of reflexively recognize those ways in which we've been taught to not see or recognize or overemphasize certain connections or read them in a particular way, right? How can we see them in a new form, right? How can we also kind of open our eyes to those ways in which we give nature and animals this kind of cultural and social meaning as well, right? As like a first step of also of recognizing.
So one question I had for both of you guys, really, but in a way, Gina, I think it might relate to you just kind of mobilizing your biological knowledge, is just to talk about how we would think about this example of the multi-species community in a greater context of, like, the multi-species communities that we all kind of live with. So, yeah.
Right. I mean, I think many of them that are really influential for us are kind of invisible. Mm-hmm. Like one example that does not involve intelligent species would be thinking about our microbiome, for instance. And this is something I'm sure all of you have heard about. You know that we're a colony. We have 1,000 species of microbes that coexist with us. And these are really critical symbiotic relationships. We obviously give them a place to live, and we supply them with nutrients, but they supply us with nutrients as well. It sort of changes your perspective on the world when you think about yourself not as a just an individual, but actually as this incredibly complex colony that we depend upon. And the influences. Some of this is overhyped probably, but it goes beyond just supplying nutrients. There's growing evidence that some of these microbes generate neuroactive compounds that actually influence our mood and our behavior in very important ways. So that's a really odd thing to think about. It's completely, most of the time, invisible to us, unless you have to take antibiotics for something and then you feel really bad for a while, and that's because you've kind of decimated this community, and it actually has to regrow, and it isn't gonna come back the same way it did necessarily, right? Because you might have wiped out some elements of that complicated, these are all interacting with each other and they fill different niches and, so that's one, I think, sort of interesting aspect, is that a lot of these communities, like this is a very visible example, right, where you see these people depend upon these animals for their livelihood. It's just really intertwined into the way they every aspect of how they live. But there are all these invisible connections like that we're subject to all the time. I wonder what the alpaca eye view is on this. What do the alpaca get from this relationship? I mean, it's really clear that what the human gain is, and that this is a really respectful relationship. But from the alpaca's point of view, why don't they just disappear into the Andes and not come back? I remember seeing them wandering around up into the hills, and nothing's keeping them, right?
Yeah, and they don't run away like that. But one of the things that happens because of the ways in which humans have not evolved by themselves, right? Like we've evolved alongside with different kinds of animals. Some we've co-evolved.
Especially.
Yeah, with dogs we've co-evolved. Yeah. Others, we've made them evolve into things. Mm-hmm. They need to be sheared. Like sheep too, right? And there was this like really story a couple of years ago, a really interesting story about this runaway sheep in Australia that got lost for I don't know how many months, and they couldn't find it, and eventually someone stumbled upon it, and the wool had grown so large that it had got caught between trees and it couldn't move, and who knows for how long it had been like dangling in the forest or in the bush. And so alpacas need humans to shear them, right? They could not just, because it's just going to keep growing. So then that hinders their life. They also get medical attention if they get sick, right? Or if they're injured, they get this kinds of human and veterinary or kind of indigenous forms of care. They get... if we go into kind of Andean cosmology, or the mythology, right? The alpacas are the animals that move in between the kind of spirit realm and the human realm as well. So they're this kind of very interesting being.
Can I connect that to something Gina said at the beginning? Because I hear you saying there's an importance to the specificity of an indigenous form of respect, the way that these are animals that are woven into a coherent cosmology. But Gina, you also began by saying, like, we worry about getting cut off from our larger biological context. So the question I have is kind of tricky. It's about, like, I want to respect the difference of the indigenous forms of knowledge or understanding as opposed to, you know, our own Waltham perspective, but also think about the common threads there. You know, because there's a way to tell the story where that is, like, you can, alienate that as a form of knowledge. But I don't hear you doing that. I think it's more like, it actually is connected to Gina's point about, like, being aware of webs of commonness or something.
Yeah, I, as an anthropologist, I think it's important to recognize indigenous knowledge and points of view as well. And I think it also speaks to, right, how our culture and our society and our sets of beliefs allow us to see and understand nature in particular ways, and then that shapes our behavior towards nature. So regardless of the truthfulness, right, if the alpacas are actually this being that could do this or not, understanding them in this way and imagining that they have this other kind of point of view makes humans treat the alpacas and their environment in a particular way that I think is very different from us, and that, you know, if we can recognize, you know, how do we see kind of animals, right? How do we see those relationships? What kind of knowledge do we value about animals? We can see how that shapes how we behave towards animals, what animals we want around us, what animals we don't want to see and want to do away with, which ones are okay as pets, which ones are not okay as pets, what kind of, who we want in our community and who we don't want and why. I think we're really not conscious about that, and that lack of seeing has big consequences.
Mm-hmm. So I want to connect that. I've been dying to ask about, basically, this is the question about pigeons and rats. So I don't exactly know how to formulate it, but, you know, we humans, you know, Gina, again, you said we are sort of cut off from our awareness of our environment, but in another way, we have successfully kind of wasted / transformed so much of the globe. And of course, you know, cows live on that globe and chickens live on that globe, but also all of these species that we think of as kind of dirty, but they depend on a human condition. So how do you guys think about that? I mean, not so much untainted wilderness, but just like the waste, you know, which is made by humans, but it isn't only inhabited by humans.
Right. I mean, I think we're at a point in, human takeover of the planet, if you will, where, you know, no animal species can avoid interacting with humans. I mean, there's almost no place on Earth where you can have a community of animals that doesn't have to in some way deal with us, right? And some animal communities have adapted to that very well. And I was actually thinking about corvids, which are one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah, they're so smart.
So corvids are crows, ravens, jays, rooks. And they're just an incredibly, playful, intelligent, and what's interesting is that many of those species actually have thrived as human populations have grown. And part of the reason for that is that they're really adaptable. You know, they're omnivores. They can eat just about anything. So they'll eat pet food, or they'll eat they eat roadkill, right? All sorts of things that humans provide in abundance. And at the same time, you know, our relationship with them is not necessarily just as a relationship with a pest, right? I mean, if you think about the role that crows and ravens have played in all sorts of mythologies and religions, they've had this really important impact on the way humans view the world and again, the relationship between when us and these different aspects of being. You know, crows are typically the trickster animals, right?
Yeah. Spiders too. Yeah.
Right. So there are interesting situations where these animals have really managed to take advantage of what human culture has generated. And of course, there's many examples where the outcome has been much sadder than that. I spent quite a bit of time trying to befriend some crows in my yard during the pandemic.
Yeah.
But I had this neighbor who subsequently moved out, but he didn't like crows very much, just put it that way. He was trying to grow all of these vegetables and yeah. hops and things like that the crows were always raiding. And so he would sit on his porch with his, shotgun.
Yeah.
And he would, and the crows knew I wasn't him, but they still didn't trust me because, I would talk to him and I would, I'd tell him not to shoot the crows. But so they can recognize different people and really adapt their behavior to that.
But I like that I threw up pigeon as an example, which is one where we feel squeamish about an animal that does well close to us. But a crow is a better example because it's kind of, it's got a little bit of independent agency or something. Yeah,
absolutely. And when you start to think about, how we view or how we can understand, alien consciousnesses, I think the crow is also a great example to think about, especially if you contrast it to an octopus, for instance. They're a bird, really different evolutionarily from mammals, and yet they can use tools, solve complex problems, communicate. I hear these calls. Some of them say, "Oh, someone's bringing food to the compost pile." And then all the crows converge, so you can actually differentiate some of their calls.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I think that's something. I was thinking about pigeons and thinking about not only pigeons, but all these other animals that now, because of how we've encroached in their spaces, are now entering and living in urban areas. Like if that wasn't common before, right? So like in Europe, there's a big issue with boars. So now you find wild boars in most cities because they kind of need to live and they're kind of adapting, and some of them become pests and others are kind of welcome. And it's interesting to think about, right? I'm from Puerto Rico and almost all the animals we have there are invasive species, like the bigger ones. So we have like Vietnamese pigs, which are super cute, are adorable, are pets for most people. But now there's an overpopulation of them, they've gone wild and they're a pest for us, right? Or thinking about our national frog, the coqui, which is this tiny little tree frog that sings at night, and for us it's like the best sound to go to bed. And somehow they ended up in Hawaii and they're a pest. People can't stand them, right? And they can't wait to displace this kind of community out of the area. And to think about also, what is it about particular kinds of animals and the ways they make themselves at home in our spaces that allows us to welcome them or not, right? I think it's
I was thinking about that Thomas Hardy line, which Mary Douglas gets credit for it, but it's really Thomas Hardy: dirt is matter out of place. So it's like a pet, from pet to pest is just a semantic distinction. It's not a, So I think this is a related question. It, basically, given that we're thinking about what we stand to learn from multi-species communities, so there's a lot of species out there with complex social structures and intelligence like the crow. I was thinking actually about ants, which are, it is true that humans have impacted them, but they seem kind of unchanged by that, you know. So as we contemplate the implications of the Anthropocene, that is like a world that we have put our big thumb everywhere, what can we learn from other species that might inform our own way of being in the world?
Want to start?
I kind of, as an anthropologist, the way I think about this question again goes back to, you know, I think there's a very common way of still seeing what we can learn about animals, and there's this very kind of instrumental way. And I'm thinking here, there's another anthropologist who studied bees and how the military studies bee behavior to develop the technology, right? So that we can kind of continue putting our mark in more and more and more spaces. So my interest, I think, is that when we go outside of our Western kind of viewpoint, right, that we've grown up in, where nature is out there and we are humans and we have culture and we mold nature to our needs, even if that need is to appreciate it, right, and go on a hike and eliminate human trace from it, right? Like when we go outside of that framework, which is also part of the perspective that has allowed us to intervene in the natural world to the point that we've, you know, messed up with geology, geological time. I think, you know, stepping out of that perspective and seeing how other folks around the world see and understand themselves in relation to nature, or maybe see themselves as part of nature and what that entails, can give us ideas for how to see differently, how we relate to nature, and potentially think of other ways of tackling these issues that aren't just like, oh, bees are really good at this, let's like use electronic and AI to mimic it to further our interest, right? So like I said, like, you know, I learned a lot from people, how people herd alpacas, but I think what I took out of it was a different way of not like, oh, now I'm going to go to the alpaca farm and tell people how to properly take care of the animals so they can do it better, but kind of a different sensibility of how to think of myself in relation to animals, how to treat the animals, how to engage with them, how to reckon with the fact that I'm a human and I eat meat and I also care about animals and the environment, right? And maybe the option is not being vegan, but like, how can I kind of rethink my position in relation to something I deeply care about so that I could kind of maybe work towards a different kind of shift? So using those ideas to be more imaginative.
Yeah, I can think of so many answers to that. Some of them are utilitarian, and you know, there's a lot of utilitarian answers, but I actually want to give it maybe a slightly different one. You know, thinking as a neuroscientist, and again, thinking back to this book that you all read about octopuses, you know, part of, I think, what we can get out of interacting with other species and other communities of animals is a real expansion in our view of you know, the way ways of being in the world, ways of forming a society. I mean, a lot of these animals have very complex social structures, and they're very different from ours. Or, you know, again, think, you know, watching an animal like a crow solve a problem in a way that might blow your mind that they could do this, but it might be very different from the way you would solve that problem also. Yeah. And so I think it can give us this incredible appreciation for diversity, that is, diverse ways of solving problems, diverse ways of being in the world that is incredibly useful for us as a species, because if we're gonna really make progress as we go forward and have happier, you know, interactions with people who do things different ways and have different beliefs and different ways of being in the world, then I think those perspectives are really incredibly valuable. So, and it's also just, there's real beauty in it, you know. So yeah. For me, that, I think that that's maybe the, you know, for me, that's why I like to go out in the world and see other species doing the things they do, you know. It's,
I mean, those films of crows playing by sliding down snow piles, like those are, they're beautiful, you're right. I was going to say they were fun, but that's the wrong word. Beautiful is a better word, yeah. So I just want to wind down here with just a few related announcements. I will say that Gina continues her fabulous work on sleep and brain plasticity, but I also wanted to mention that Patricia, I think this is right, you're now making a film about the color magenta. Is that true? That's an amazing, okay. Well, that's a conversation for next year.
It's an open process right now. I'm working on one on thoroughbred racehorses in Kentucky.
That's, wow.
And the magenta one.
And I also wanted to say, if this topic interests you guys, please go to the podcast that Elizabeth Ferry and I run together, Recall This Book. If you subscribe to it tonight, tomorrow morning at 4 a.m., the next episode is coming out, which is our conversation with Professor Godfrey Smith while he was here at Brandeis. So we actually go into some of these questions about bird intelligence in that conversation. And the book, the website also has further material, including an amazing essay that Professor Ferry found about touch in chimpanzees. So another way of thinking about these communities. So you guys, thank you so much. That was just a wonderful.
That concludes our live recording of a Brandeis critical conversation envisioned specifically as part of our multi-species month that we call this book. This podcast is sponsored by Brandeis and the Mandel Humanities Center, sound editing by Naomi Cohen, website design and social media by Miranda Peary of the English Department. Gina, Patrizia, and I are eager to hear your comments, criticisms, and thoughts on today's discussion. So please write a review or rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. And from all of us here at RTB, thanks for listening.